Kaylin, I appreciate you doing this. I'm a huge fan of yours, so this is an honor.
Well, thank you. That's very nice to hear.
Have you ever seen anyone reading a book of yours in public?
God, not in a while. It's been, when I had my first book come out, it went to a second printing in like 3 weeks. And that was in the days when the first printing was 40,000 copies. So that was really exciting, but true crime books today don't sell like they used to, unfortunately. And my audience is now really more national than it is local. So
The first time you saw someone, though, reading your book, did you approach them?
I don't remember.
Oh!
No, I don't. Like, I ran into a guy I used to work with at the newspaper last night, and he's like, "Yeah, here, meet my friend Steve. We're both in a book club." And I'm thinking to myself, does he know I write books? And I didn't even say anything. So, I'm not the kind of person that needs like affirmation from everybody all the time that I'm going to be like, "Hey, did you know that I'm a New York Times bestselling author?" I didn't. I'm not that kind of person. So, I'd have to put these on so I can see you.
Awesome. Born in Canada, moved to Cali, La Jolla. What do you, it's so picturesque when you Google it and stuff. What do you remember most about growing up there?
Well, let's see. I was 1 year and 10 months old, so I don't really remember very much. It's on my green card. I don't have a green card anymore, but I did have a green card for a very long time as a baby. And it's illegal to not get a new card. So I was still traveling on my baby green card when I was in my, I don't know, 20s. And they're like, this really doesn't look like you anymore. Anyway, we moved to Ventura County. I don't know if you know where that is, but Santa Barbara, because my parents were in the PhD program there, and it's very beautiful. It's on the beach, and so we've always kind of tried to be near the beach. And so my mom still lives in La Jolla, which is where I grew up from junior high and high school. But California it's got great weather, although it suddenly got cold last night, and I'm wearing a scarf. So it can be really hot and then it can get really cold like overnight. I went to a club last night because it was my partner's boyfriend and we got these tickets from a friend and that we were under two air conditioning vents. So I'm so
Oh
warm.
You can't break it. That's great.
Yeah.
So first Cal Berkeley for psych, and then you show up and you do Northwestern for journalism, which is amazing. Two completely different avenues. What made you choose both of them? Was it like a career path after Berkeley? What happened?
Well, I wanted to be a therapist originally
Okay.
when I kind of figured out what I wanted to do. And then so I took these psychology classes and I was sitting in an abnormal psychology class and they were playing these tapes of therapy sessions with very, very disturbed people. I remember this and I said to myself, I don't want to do this every day. I have enough problems of my own that I don't need to deal with somebody else's problems all day long every day. And then so what's ironic about that is I went into journalism and newspapers and I ended up covering social services and mental illness and mental health in jails and prisons because that's where people end up. And then when I left newspapers to write books, a lot of my books deal with mentally ill people who kill other people. So I really managed to, that's always been an interest of mine. And I'm kind of back where I was, where, it is part of my life, or it was when I was writing true crime full time. I was dealing with crazy people every day, just like I said, I didn't want to. So, it's really not unrelated. It's actually all woven together because everything that I've ever done, I'm using in some fashion. And now I've moved into fiction because true crime takes a toll. I got to tell you. I've written 17 books, actually more than that. Some of them didn't get published because I worked on the proposal, wasn't able to sell it, or I had a partner, co-author, and some of these things fell apart. So I actually have done more books than that, but some of them didn't see, the light of day. They got canceled during COVID or, whatever. So I've written 17, and the latest two haven't been, the latest three actually have not been published yet, but I have, they're all under contract and they're going to come out, but the latest two are fiction. So I've kind of decided to move into something that's more fun for me. I originally started out wanting to be a fiction author, mm-hmm. but I didn't really know what I didn't know, but I just didn't know the material well enough and the way people think. So, you know, I thought, well, I get along with men pretty well. I think I know how they think. In fact, I sometimes say, you know, I get along better with men oftentimes than women. And so I thought, well, I can write a book from the viewpoint of a man. That's not a problem. Well, guess what? I'm not a man. So anyway, long story short, I've got two, I've started writing a series of detective books. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about that. It's really fun to be writing again, something that makes me happy, because the darkness of the true crime and all the legal issues, and it's just too hard these days. It's really complicated, and I can talk about it if you want, but it's really so much harder today to write a true crime book than it was when I first started out. So I'm kind of, you know, my life's changed. And this is good. And I'm getting more into TV and, mm-hmm. and we're trying to get series produced and things like that, which I also can't talk about right now because I'm in negotiations, but it's all exciting. It's like I'm in a whole new phase of my career. So it's fun.
The new chapter of your life. Cause when you and I were texting with each other, emailing, you told me about you. So you were like a free agent. So do they come to you? How does that happen?
I can do whatever I want.
Inside baseball. It's like, hey, Caitlin, we have a proposal for you, two or three books. Is that how it happened? Like they came to you?
No, that is not anywhere near where it happened.
Tell me.
You have to totally work really, really hard. You have to rewrite books about a million times. I've been through, I don't know how many agents trying to get this book published. It took 17 years of overhauling and rewriting and showing it to agents. I'm like, no, it's just still not there. You know, anyway, finally get it accepted. And then I wrote the second one, not overnight, but really quickly, so quickly that I literally hurt my hand, my wrists and my arms, and I injured myself from typing so much so fast. So I'm now on the third book in the series. And now that I have a contract for the first two, now there's all this pressure. Like, oh no, do I know what I'm doing? Because I haven't been edited yet, so who knows what they're, you know, they liked them enough to buy the first one, but they haven't read the second one, and I'm still working on the third one. But my hope is to get the series going, so I have two books come out, they'll do well, they'll sell well, then I get another two-book deal for three and four, and then go from there. But so now it's like a job. So it's, you know, before I was just writing and manifesting. So no, they did not come to me. I worked super, super hard and I had to go get it. And it's all about resilience and, you know, rebounding from rejection.
The authors I have on mostly are nonfiction, true crime writers, biographies, all that stuff. And they like the nonfiction because the story's told for them. Here's a story. Do you like the fiction aspects where your creativity can really show, like, hey, I want to go this angle instead of that?
Well, this is what's funny. I started out wanting to write fiction, but for some reason, like I said, once I realized I really didn't know enough, I couldn't let that creativity got blocked. So then I said, you know what? I am more comfortable with nonfiction because, like you just said, the story is already there. The trick is, how do you tell it? And so with a nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, you know, I write it like a novel as much as I can with characters and dialogue mm-hmm. and scenes. And so, you know, I don't know, some true crime writers don't necessarily write narrative nonfiction. They're more, you know, former police officers or investigators who are not writers. They are not journalists. So they do information dumps, which are not very interesting to read. No. There's a lot of books out there in the genre that are not written very well. But I really try very hard to make it a compelling, novelistic kind of book. And so that's not to say, I do a huge amount of research and there will be information woven in there. But yeah, it was anyway, easier because the story is... The story's there. It's just the trick is how do you tell it in a compelling way and still work in the suspense and still keep the reader, you know, guessing on what's going to happen. Because when you do good research, you will tell the reader things they didn't know. They thought they knew the case, but by the time they're done reading my book, hopefully they'll say, you know, I thought I knew this case. And then I read the book and I'm like, wow, I didn't know this case at all. So that was really fun until it wasn't fun anymore. But what happened was I finally knew now how detectives work and how they think, because I've interviewed so many of them and I've read so many, you know, witness interview transcripts, and I've watched the video or listened to the audio of the detectives actually interviewing these suspects. And so I literally do know, and I've gotten to be friends with people, and, you know, a lot of police officers have a really good sense of humor. They're very kind of dark humor. They cuss a lot, you know, and they're sarcastic, you know. And so that's who my character ends up being, you know. So, and parts of me are in my characters. But now that I know my material, now the creativity can come out. And now I hear the characters talking in my head. And now it's fun. And now I can do it. But I tried originally. It wasn't there yet.
I want to backtrack to what you said, a lot of our information dumps. What I love so much about your books, I think I've read like 4 or 5 of your books, is that obviously you tell the story of the crime, but you also delve and make the reader knowledgeable about mental illness, addiction. You kind of go psych on them. You know, like, I guess that's the Cal Berkeley stuff. Is that always something you want to put in the book? Because, like, as I'm reading, I'm like, oh, wow, like, I know about addiction in my family, but you really go into a lot of the stuff with it. Is that always a point of emphasis that you want to put on it?
Well, there are, you know, I choose particular cases for a reason. I mean, there's like a set of little bells that have to kind of go off. Like, is this going to be interesting for me to research and for me to stick with a story for as long as it's going to take to research the book, to write the book, and then to promote the book and talk about the book over and over and over again until I can't stand the sound of my own voice. But it better be a good case, and it better hit those little bells that are my points of personal interest. And so, yes, I am drawn to cases that involve people who are mentally ill or have addiction issues. I also think it's really fascinating when religion plays into book, because oftentimes you'll have somebody who kills somebody, and there's some kind of religious aspect to the case where they are using religion to con other people. You know, in Dead Reckoning, there was a guy who is a Long Beach insane Crips member, and he's been in prison for attempted murder. He's, you know, used drugs. He's, you know, done a lot of things. And he's supposedly reformed, right? And he's like a month away from being a minister, because he's a minister in training. He's got a handyman business called Christian Hands. And what does he do? He meets Skylar DeLeon, and within like 20 minutes, he's convinced to go kill these people, throw them off a boat. And so, you know, now he's on death row. But my point is, you know, and another person who was involved in this same murder, Jennifer DeLeon, she was brought up in an evangelical Christian home, and she and her husband, Skylar DeLeon, who has since transitioned to be a woman and just recently got taxpayer subsidized gender affirming surgery, and that was the motive for the murder, that Skylar wanted money to pay for this surgery, which she had already put a deposit down, but didn't have money to pay for the rest of the surgery. That's a motive for the murder. And here she is all these years later, gets taxpayer funded surgery, which is the motive for her murder. I don't even know how that managed to get approved. But my point is, these are the fascinating things to me that I pick a case for. I didn't know all that about Skylar when I started, but, you know, and they didn't present that information in the courtroom. So I think it's really important for me to go into these cases with a really open mind and see what I find. But the case originally, you know, it was a local case. It was a very sympathetic family. I mean, there's certain things you need to look for in order to make a case work to write about. But yeah, I mean, And I wouldn't say he's mentally ill, but he does have a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It's called severe, you know, gender dysphoria. And I do believe that that really did play a part in his motivation for killing people. So even though I didn't set out thinking that this case was going to involve any kind of mental illness or mental health issue, it ended up becoming that. So, but my themes are addiction, mental illness. I also pick, I tend to pick cases where, you know, there's some kind of con man or con woman and a lot of psychological manipulation, you know, in various, I think that's fascinating. And I don't like blood and gore. So I don't really want to do the serial killer books, although I have done one or two of those. I do like a psychological aspect, and that's how I tell the story, because I don't want to write a book that I don't want to read.
That's interesting to say. Do you ever, as you're writing a book, do you ever get nervous like, oh crap, I hope someone else isn't writing a similar book and who gets it out quick? Does that ever go through your head?
It has happened where there have been authors who have covered the same case and they've gotten their book out first, and my book is way more authoritative and comprehensive because they didn't go to the trial, or they didn't wait for the trial. Or if they did, they put 5 pages about the trial. And I've got, you know, like a third of the book is, or 25% of the book is the trial. And you have to go to the trial because all this information comes out at the trial that you didn't know about before. So these books that come out, these quick hit books that come out before mine, and it's happened several times. It's very annoying because they take the market away. A piece of my market away, but there are people who will buy both books, but it is annoying when that happens. So, you know, you want to try to pick a case that somebody hasn't already written a book about. And it's easier these days because the true crime, the stable of true crime writers is much smaller these days. It's too hard and it's too hard to sell. And there's fewer and fewer publishers who are publishing it. And there are fewer people buying it, which is part of the reason why I'm moving into fiction, and I'm excited about that because that's a very popular genre. But it's also super crowded, so it's like it's a whole other end of the spectrum. I have to compete with like a million crime writers.
Yeah, but like, your name's so heavy. You have a heavy name.
Well, I'm glad you think so, but...
No, Caitlin, you're a New York Times bestselling author. Oh, let me ask you about that. What book was it, and how did you get notified? Was it a phone call like, hey, by the way, you're about to be a New York Times bestselling author? How'd that happen?
Well, actually, it's funny because it was for a memoir that I wrote with Scott and Joan Bolzan. It's nothing to do with true crime, although there is a crime in it. It's about a guy who was a football player with the Cleveland Browns, and he married his college sweetheart. And he played football, then he left football and became an entrepreneur. And one day, you know, he went into the bathroom and slipped on something slippery and fell and hit his head. And within a couple hours, he had lost his entire long-term memory. It's gone. He didn't know who his wife was. He didn't even know what the word wife meant. So he lost a lot of his language. Oh my God. He lost all of his experience. He lost all of his context. He didn't know who he was. He didn't remember anything. So that was a really, once again, a psychological story, an interesting medical and psychological story about how he rebuilt his life and had to recreate some memories. But some memories that he had shared with his wife, like the miscarriage of one of their children, she had those memories and he didn't have those anymore. So that was very difficult for her because it's like, wow, this is such a huge part of my life. And now he doesn't even remember it. So, I mean, that's what that book was about. And it was with Harper One, which is a big publisher. And they had a tremendous publicist who got them on 3 TV shows, national TV shows in one day. Oof. And downloading the book while they were watching these people on TV. And so we got on I think we were in 2 different categories, but one of them was the combined hardcover and ebook. And I think I got an email about it, but that was super exciting because that's the only time I've ever done it. And so now that's my title. And, you know, it's really hard to get. Mm-hmm. And it's super exciting. It was always one of my goals, you know, so that's checked off my list now. Of course, you want to hit it again.
Of course. And you almost won a Pulitzer, didn't you? What was that for?
Well, I was nominated by my newspaper, which is actually different from being a nominee, a Pulitzer nominee. So I've taken that off my websites and stuff because I've been told since that you're not really allowed to say you're a Pulitzer Prize nominee unless you make it to this certain point in the contest where they categorize you as that. So yeah, it was really exciting to be nominated by my newspaper, and I was nominated twice. But this one story was about a 19-year-old local guy who another one of my themes, by the way, is suicide that I end up being drawn to in various books. And that's partly because maybe because, I don't know, my husband killed himself. So anyway, this guy's 19 years old and he graduated high school and he was getting ready to go into the military. And he went to the parking lot of a Walmart and there was like a kind of a bushy area right there off to the side. And he poured some kind of flammable liquid over himself and lit himself on fire. And he was dead within, I don't know, 12 hours or something. And the premise of the story was, if he had known, and this is what I got from his family and from his girlfriend, if he had known how much this was going to hurt other people, he probably wouldn't have done it. Okay. And if he'd known how much it was going to hurt him, because, you know, burns are in, like
12 hours.
And, you know, his mother couldn't even touch him to say goodbye because he was in so much pain. He was like so burnt. And so that's what that story was about, because his parents, nobody knew, but he had left all these signs, but they didn't recognize them, that he was in so much pain inside, you know, with depression. And so
back to your newest venture, the fiction books, the crime series, which is so cool. When is that coming out?
Well, I just signed the contract yesterday.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But my editor is on maternity leave, so it's kind of going to take a little bit longer than it would otherwise. But it's scheduled for release in January of 2026. But I have two books coming out next year, which are true crime books. Mm-hmm. If you want me to just mention those.
Heck yeah.
Okay. The one in February 25th, is called Body Parts. Mm-hmm. And here, I have a little, oh, no, you can't see. I was thinking we were on TV, but we're not. I was going to hold up the books. I have two books, and they're both the original cover and then the reissued cover. So it came out in 2009, and then it got reissued in 2013 with a different cover, but no new information. And I was really disappointed because the second cover issue never got into bookstores. So it sold online and it sold as an ebook, and it is my second best-selling book. And if they had put it in the bookstore, you know, think about how many more it would have sold. So I was really excited. It went out of print, and now I wrote an update, a 10,000-word update. Oh. Because there were some new developments in this case. So it's about Wayne Adam Ford. Mm-hmm. He's a serial killer. And I mentioned this is my serial killer book, and so now I don't really need to write another one because it's pretty gruesome and it's a pretty
one and done. Yes.
Yeah, it was the darkest 9 months of my life, and I had chronic pain during the period that I was writing this book. I had 26 sessions of acupuncture. I had so much pain in my back and my neck and my arms. Anyway, because I wrote two books back to back, and I just hurt myself. You can't do that, and I've learned now to take breaks and to pace myself and not sit in the same position all the time. I use voice activated software if it starts getting bad again. Mm-hmm. But this book is about a guy who is a long haul trucker, and he would pick up these troubled women. Again, the guy had issues.
Yes.
Psychological issues. He had what's called paraphilias, which are like fetishes, but to the 10th degree. So he had all of these really weird fixations on breasts, and, you know, with his wife, he would like poke her breasts with needles and do all this really weird stuff. And this is before he killed anybody. But he had a severe head injury also when he was about 19 years old. He was a Marine. And here's another thing that has been common in a number of my books are people who've been in the military and who are taught how to kill.
Yeah.
our government, and they have that knowledge. So Skylar DeLeon, Marcus Wesson, Wayne Adam Ford, those are just three that off the top of my head. And anyway, so this guy basically would take these women, he'd take them into the back of the truck and start having sex with them, which they were fine with, but they weren't fine with what he did during the sex. He started having really rough sex. He'd start choking them. He would, you know, do bad things and torture them and burn them and do other stuff, that which they did not consent to. And then he would start choking them, and he'd choke them out, and then they'd pass out. He'd do CPR and bring them back and do it again.
Oh, my God.
Multiple times. Yeah. And then these four women did not come back. So his argument was, well, it was an accident because, you know, I've done this to, like, you know, 50 women, and these four, you know, it was just an accident because they didn't come back. I'm like, well, you know, you do it once and they die, you know, okay, maybe it's an accident. They do it twice.
Yeah.
But two, three, and four, it's not really an accident anymore. If you know that this people can die when you do this, maybe you should stop calling it an accident. And so he killed these women, but he was such a messed up guy, you know, and I'm reading these transcripts of the interviews with him. He turned himself in.
Yeah.
He knew he was going to keep killing. And so he called up his brother and he's like, you know, I need your help, because he knew he couldn't do it without his brother's help. And his, you know, his brother made him turn himself in because he was still trying to get out of it the next day, you know. So anyway, he dismembered his first victim that he killed. And so for 25 years, she remained unidentified. They found her torso originally, and they found one of her arms in two different places. And so that's what they had. They kept the tissue, and they kept them frozen in Humboldt County, California. And then 25 years later, you know, this little sheriff's department started doing the cold cases with the forensic genetic genealogy. And her cousin had submitted his DNA to a GED match, which is one of those sites which allows police access, specifically give permission to allow your DNA to be used to solve crime cases, because there was a big controversy during the whole Golden State Killer thing that, you know, well, I didn't give permission for my DNA to be used. And I kind of figure if you're living a good life, I don't really think you need to worry about it coming to your house and arresting you for murder, you know. But if you have something to worry about, usually they get one of your relatives, though. It's not you,
yes.
Right? So, anyway, so they figured out who she was 25 years later. Her name is Carrie Ann Cummings. And so I wrote, you know, 10,000 words about how she now has her name back. Her family has closure. And it's, you know, if you can have a happy ending to a serial killer book, it now has one. And so that's coming out in February. And then I've got a bigger book coming out in June. And the release has been delayed three times, which has never happened to me before. And that's literally why I have written three novels, because I was so frustrated with my publisher withholding the book. Basically, it was in legal review for a really long time. There were some internal problems at the publisher, which they didn't tell us about. And so I didn't know what was going on. And I was so frustrated and I was angry and I needed to do something. So I started writing these novels. And so, you know, I managed to take a downtime, which was forced on me, and turned it into, you know, and I didn't know if these books were going to get published. Mm-hmm. Because I'd been trying for 17 years to get the damn thing published. And I couldn't get it published. So I just did it because I couldn't sit still and just wait any longer. So it was a blessing in disguise. But anyway, so this book is coming out. It's called Down to the Bone, and it's about the McStay family murders. Now, the book that I my latest book is called Death on Ocean Boulevard. Mm-hmm. Came out during the pandemic.
Yes.
I had a completely virtual tour on my computer at home and podcasting and all that stuff. I couldn't do any live events. So it's kind of like that was part one. And this is kind of part two, because it's the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, which has some serious.
Oh, yeah.
It's homicide and missing persons department division, whatever. And so both cases the people involved are claiming confirmation bias. So in the first case, the department ruled Rebecca Zahow's hanging death. She was found naked, bound, and gagged. A suicide. Her family says, no way, she was murdered, because how could she do that to herself? She would never do that to herself. Hang yourself naked, you know, from a courtyard in the backyard, her husband's mansion. Anyway, so part two of that is the McStay case. So the defense in this case of the man who is, it's kind of hard to say now, because he was convicted and sent to death row, but they've now gotten rid of death row and he's been moved. So Wayne Adam Ford is now in some prison in San Luis Obispo, and this guy, Chase Merritt, is now in Donovan State Prison. There's no longer a death row, so I don't know what to call them anymore. Are they? They're not really on death row anymore.
No, they're not, right?
They were sentenced to death, so, anyway. They were on death row until just like a couple months ago. To recalibrate everything, the way I talk. So Chase Merritt is on death row, and his defense spent the whole trial basically saying, there is another guy who had even, you know, the same, if not more, of the same motive. And why wasn't he ever arrested or a suspect? And so it's about confirmation bias that they picked. Mm-hmm. They picked a guy. They picked an idea and a theory. And then no amount of evidence that they couldn't find to support it would ever make them change their mind. So it's basically going to, you know, talk about the case, which was investigated by the San Diego Sheriff's Department as a missing persons case, even though everybody was telling them this is something, there's something really wrong. This family would not just get up and disappear. But the detective insisted that they voluntarily went to Mexico and dropped the case, basically. There's nothing more for me to do. And then, boom, 8 months later, their skeletal remains are found in the desert. And, of course, they never went to Mexico. They were in the desert, buried in these two graves. So,
do you still get nervous releasing a book? Like, a book's coming out now. February. Really?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if people are going to buy it. Do they remember me? I haven't had a book out since 2021. And because this book got delayed three times, I'm like, my pre-sales are in the toilet because people don't believe it. Or people, you know, you lose your momentum when you're promoting a book. There's a way to do it. And you get people excited. And then you set the date for the book signing and the book launch. And, you know, there's a certain way to do these things. Well, the publisher, by delaying it three times, I've lost my momentum. So I don't know what's going to happen when it comes out. It may be a dud, maybe a total dud. I don't know. I mean, it's really very frustrating.
No, it is. But it seems like you have a February, June, and then January. It seems that's a nice little wave going.
Now it is, but
true crime into your next series.
Yeah, it's okay now, but now it looks like it was all planned, right?
Yeah, I'm like, but genius.
I look like a genius, right? I look like a genius, even though I had nothing to do with it.
I want to rewind real quick. When you first started writing articles in Massachusetts after Northwestern, do you remember your first piece of press that really got news? Like, people were talking about it, like, oh my God,
you know,
that's
what,
my article.
I got fired from that job.
No, did you really?
I didn't get hired past my probation. So my next job, I went right to. I didn't lose a day of work. And the people who had fired me said, oh, you don't have to leave until we replace you. So I mean, that wasn't terrible or anything. They just, you know, it's a long story, but I always like to tell it because look where I am now.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
They're like, well, you shouldn't be on TV. Why don't you go into TV? You have the looks for it. Because that's an insult, that because they didn't respect TV broadcast.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, I was a good writer, and that's why they hired me. But I wasn't a news writer, so I kept feeling like I was trying to write a feature story, and I didn't have an editor who worked with me. Like, I would send my story down over the wire, you know, to this person who I had met once, and she was in another office, and she just didn't really like me very much, I don't think. And she never worked with me. She never helped me. And it was basically trial by fire. So I just did what I did. And then it turned out to be wrong some of the time because I didn't have anybody teaching me what to do. So that's the thing about journalism is you have to learn on the job. They basically hired me out of journalism school. But journalism school is school. It's not real life.
It's not hands-on.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, I did publish some stories while I was in journalism school more than anybody else. That we had this wall that you'd tack up. You know, I would get my little stories published about the local school board or whatever, and it was like really exciting because I was getting published. And I did get an article in the Chicago Tribune, but it was a feature story about an art exhibit. So, you know, they stick me into this job and I'm covering the school board, I'm covering the, you know, Board of Selectmen. You know, in Massachusetts, every town has its own government. It's kind of an interesting thing. So they have a state government and they have a local government. The local government has a lot more power than they do here in California. So you cover your own little city. So I had three little towns, you know, and that's what I was covering, and a big development project and a hospital and a vocational school district. So, I mean, I did my best. And, you know, I was covering the town of Adams, and to this day, the town manager still loves me. We're Facebook friends. He still has the story that I wrote about him, and he still posts it with the picture that I took. And I remember taking a picture of this parade with all these little kids. So they let me take my own pictures because they thought I was a good photographer, even though I wasn't hired as a photographer. So, but then there was this one planning board meeting or something, and I wrote it like with a metaphor of a boxing match. And they really didn't like that, but it was on deadline, and so the editor couldn't change it. But it was kind of written more like a essay or an editorial. It was very creative. Well, they didn't like that, so that happened a few times. And then, you know, they're like, "Well, we're not going to hire you past your probation." I'm like, "Okay, fine. I'm going to go to this other newspaper that wanted to hire me when you did, but I picked you, so I'll just go over there." And I left them without anybody in my job, so they were like, "Oh, anyway."
Wow, that's wild.
You know, you can't keep me down. That's
Hell
basically.
no. A couple of other things. When you did the investigative reporting and stuff, were you working with like cops doing overnight shifts, meeting all different characters, or how'd that work?
No, I mean, being an investigative reporter is actually, you have to earn that title. I mean, people may say, "Oh, I was an investigative reporter," but you know, you have to learn that as a skill. And so, I mean, I was learning as a reporter all that time that I was a reporter. I was a reporter for 19 years before I quit to write books. And some reporters are more investigative than others. You know, I love paper, I love records, I love documents, I love going to the. I used to be scared of the courthouse because it was like so foreign to me, and I didn't understand. There's so many different courts and so many different levels, and I don't understand what they do, and I don't know how to find anything. And but once I learned how to navigate that system, oh my God, there's so much information in there that you can get that you can't get anywhere else. But unfortunately, that has now changed. And so that is one of the reasons why it is no longer easy to write these books, because they've taken all that stuff out of the court files, at least here in California, because our governor believes in rehabilitation for criminals, and he believes that if you have all this information in their court files, they can't get jobs, people know bad things about them, and people won't hire them, and their lives, you know, they can't be productive citizens. Well, I'm sorry, it's really messing with my life. So I'm like, we need to know what criminals did. So now we can't. Now we're not going to know. You know?
Another
I mean, I
no
see what he's saying, but by the same token, you know, I can't do my job anymore. And people, you know, the media right now is a huge mess. Oh my God, just look at the way the presidential election is being covered. The media needs a major overhaul. And there's billionaires running newspapers now, and there's hedge funds running newspapers now. These people have no business running the media.
I actually, I'm glad you brought it up, not to speak too much about politics, but you worked in politics, you were reporting on it. Are you happy that you're not involved in this trend?
Yes,
Okay,
I
I
am.
was curious.
Oh my God. You know, well, it is not fun to be a reporter right now. I mean, it's
No.
dangerous and people are nasty and attack you, and I don't need that.
No.
I mean, I had that while I was a political reporter. Nothing compared to what it's like now. Oh my God, it's horrible now. There's some bad people out there and nasty people, and now they believe that they're empowered to just treat people with complete disrespect. The things that people are saying right now, I mean, at these rallies and stuff, I'm just like, I can't believe people. This is just people, not even talking to the media, but just talking about each other, talking about other citizens. I'm just, it's horrible at what's going on right now. I'm really sickened. I basically have decided I can't watch any more TV or read anything more about the election until it's over, because it makes me too upset. I can't take it anymore. I can't take it.
One career question, because I'm curious about this. And as I was walking home today, I did a quick Google search. Everything on the internet is true. So I learned, one, you're a musician, and two, I didn't know this. You wrote a book about Charles Manson.
Yes, I did.
What made you tackle that? Because that seemed like...
I got hired to. See, now that one, you asked before, do they just come to you? Sometimes they do. With true crime, they do. But with novels, they do not come to you.
Did you enjoy the Charles Manson saga, the book on it? Did you enjoy writing that, or?
How do I answer this? That was a very difficult project.
Yeah.
For many, many reasons that I cannot talk about.
Okay.
I signed an NDA for one thing, but, it was difficult, logistically. First of all, I thought the subject matter was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, the case itself, I thought I learned a tremendous amount. I went to the archives at the LA courthouse and I went through the original court files, which was just wild.
Wow.
They used to write, like, the clerk would write in pencil on this paper and it was still in there. But it was basically like somebody took the box, threw it up in the air and let all the papers go everywhere. And then they stuck it back in the box. So it was like not in any kind of order. The folders didn't make any sense. There were, whatever was in the folder, you have no idea how it got into that folder. No. But, once I went through box after box after box, it was really fascinating stuff. And I couldn't find anybody to interview because nobody would cooperate. And it was a 50-year-old case. Try writing a book about history without talking to people, without anybody being willing. The agencies, like I got a hold of the sheriff's department, who had apparently 50 boxes of materials. And, the sergeant was like, sure, no problem, but I need to run it up the chain. Okay, well, then I got blocked.
Yeah, of course you did.
I was never able to look in anything. I finally got the DA's office to agree to show me some stuff. And so they sent me a CD with a bunch of files and stuff on it and trial transcripts. And so I was able to get some good stuff. I was able to get some state hospital files for Tex Watson, which you would never be allowed to use today because of HIPAA and privacy and all that kind of stuff. So I got on Facebook and I got into these Manson fan groups and these people who are really into the history. Mm-hmm. And there was this woman I met who was an excellent researcher, and she helped me actually find some things. And then a key thing that I found was parole hearing transcripts. So that was how I managed to get new information into the book, because these people like Patricia Krenwinkel, mm-hmm. And I keep forgetting her name, the one who was just released, the former beauty queen.
Not Atkins, was it Susan? No.
Susan Atkins died of brain cancer. And it was the other night with Leslie. I can't remember her last name.
Oh, Van something, right?
The pretty Leslie. One.
Yes, yeah. Van Houten or something?
Yeah, Leslie Van Houten, thank you. And then there were some other ones, they're all still in there. And they would come up for parole and they would tell things that they were never able to tell at the time because they were still in this cult and brainwashed and scared of Manson. Manson died after I turned the book in. I had to rewrite the last chapter like 5 times because I kept having to update it because, his grandson comes forward and he's fighting in court to get control of the cycle of the this is what happens when I take Zyrtec. I can't think of
The licensing?
Intellectual property, thank you. Basically the stuff, like the artwork that Manson did or his guitar that he painted, whatever. He basically got control of his remains, but it took months to fight in court. Anyway, so there were things that happened, and I interviewed Manson's parole officer, all these years later. It was actually kind of a fun project in terms of the case itself, but it was a difficult book to write because the editor was just never satisfied and I had to rewrite it a bunch of times and that was very difficult. But anyway.
When you finish a book on Manson, on whatever the topic is, Are you done with it? Because you just invested a year of your life into it. And I know then you have to do the podcast.
That was 2 years. It was only supposed to be one. So that sometimes happens. So then, you know, what you think you're going to make mm-hmm. ends up being your income, and it's spread over 2 years instead of one. And you still have to work just as hard for the second year so that you end up losing money.
Oh.
And it's really super hard when you're writing a really long, you know, old case about a case mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, books do not pay. I have to have other things in the fire. And now I'm kind of at the age where I've worked really hard for most of my life. And I don't really feel like working that hard anymore. I just don't. And because, I mean, I've always been a workaholic, and mm-hmm. I didn't have good work life balance.
Well, 17 plus books. Of course you are. You are like a yeah. savage working. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't have that much of a social life. And, you know, I have a partner who I see on the weekends. But I mean, I just work, you know. So, yeah, the music is a good outlet.
Your life is so fascinating, and you downplay it so much. You really do. You're downplaying. Like, I was so pumped to interview you, and you're like, I'm nobody. Like, your name is heavy. How are you not?
Well, I'm glad you think so. Thank you.
I do. And one other thing.
Because I'm just in my own little world.
I get it.
What the rest of the world thinks of me or who knows about me. I mean, I'm always so surprised when people go, oh, you're right there. I'm like, oh, really? Oh, that's cool.
That's so crazy. The two crime books come out next year, obviously easily promotable true crime books. Is it more difficult to promote your newest project coming out, like the series? Is that difficult to promote?
Oh, I can't. I'm not really promoting it yet because they're not out yet. I mean, I've still got, 14 months. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm talking about it because I just got the contract. But I mean, I haven't even written a blog yet to announce that I'm doing it. So, and the trick is, you know, you don't want to do it too far in advance because people forget.
Then they'll forget about it. Yeah.
You want to build momentum. And, you know, you do that with social media and you get people involved in your life and then they start rooting for you. Hopefully that's the goal. That's the theory. That's what's happening. So, you know, promoting is something. It's an art, you know, and it's also about networking too. So you have to engage with a lot of other people and get to know other people, and then mm-hmm. you support each other, and you know. It's hard, you know. It's not like we're going to have the same readers. That's the thing. True crime readers are not fiction readers all the time. There may be some overlap, but it's pretty much like I'm starting mm-hmm. over.
Yeah, that's scary.
Well, I tried once and I didn't do a very good job. I have one novel that came out, you know, it came out in 2007. And then long story long, the publisher went into foreclosure. I ended up getting my rights back. I kind of revised and worked on it a little bit more and got it re-released by another publisher in 2014. And that's Naked Addiction. And that's the prequel to the series that's coming out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's got the same detective, but the series is really about this detective and an investigative reporter. And it's about them kind of working together and against each other, competing and being attracted to each other, but not allowed to be with each other. And they're competing and like one will get all this information that the other one couldn't get for whatever reason, mm-hmm. either skill or just, you know, cops and reporters have this, you know, this thing where they're not supposed to share with each other, right? So if the cops are always trying to protect the integrity of their investigation, and the reporters are not supposed to be sharing any information, but the cops always want the reporters to give them information, and the reporters always want the cops to give them information, and both of them aren't supposed to tell each other anything. And so, you know, so it's kind of a good conflict, but they're really attracted to each other. And they want to be together and they can't. And so there's this ethical quandary. So, and there's people spying on them and there's people trying to kill her. And, you know, so it's like, so that's a whole series, which, you know, so if you want to read about my detective, it's Detective Ken Good. You can read Naked Addiction if you want to get started.
Heck yeah, I'm excited already. You got me hyped up for it.
Yeah. Well, and that one is called Naked Addiction for a reason, because it's about sex, drugs, and murder at the beach, you know, so that's kind of the theme.
Okay, so I've had you for 50 minutes. Are you ready to finish up with some quick hit questions?
Oh, boy. Okay.
No, nothing crazy. How about this? You and I are at a bar here in New York City. You want to impress everybody. No one cares. You're a New York Times best-selling author. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back? Actually, your name drop.
I don't have any cool people in my phone.
Stop it right now. Why is your...
I don't put people in my phone.
Hi, how about the coolest person you know? You definitely know cool people.
The coolest person I've ever met? How about that?
Okay, that's a fair one.
Because, I mean, I don't have... I told you, I live in a cave at home. So, I think the coolest person is Michael Connelly.
Okay.
Michael Connelly gave me a critique on Naked Addiction and helped me improve it. And he gave me a blurb, which is on the cover of the book, and helped me sell this series, too.
Oh, really? That's a great answer, too. Okay.
He's a very nice man. But see, here's the thing. So I had a boyfriend when I worked at the LA Times who used to be Michael Connelly's editor. And they were friends. And so Michael Connelly would come over to the house. Like, my boyfriend had a party and I met him. And then we went to the U2 went to a U2 concert with Michael Connelly and his wife. So that's how I met him. That's how, I mean, I don't know him very well, but I do know him.
That's a good answer. We have to work on your confidence. That's the next thing we're doing.
I'm a humble person. No. It's not like I don't have anything to say. I got plenty to say, but wouldn't you rather me be modest and humble than me being an arrogant jerk?
Yes, but I also want you to know your worth, and your name's pretty heavy.
Well, I don't think it is really heavy. Who knows me? I mean, I've been on 2020 twice, yes. Which is like 4 million people, so that's really cool. I know that.
I bet you, because I have a lot of true crime authors on, I bet you if I told the authors I had on a lot of New York Times bestsellers, they would know who you are.
Well, do you do a quiz and let me know, because I don't feel that way. And if that's really true, I would love to know that. But I don't know who knows me.
Okay, I won't name drop, but I have like 4 or 5 authors coming on in the next 2 months. And when I finish up with quick hit questions, I'm going to ask if they know you. Is that fair? And I'm going to send you the link.
Go right ahead. Please do. And they'll be like, huh? Who's that?
All right, a couple more. Last show you binged watched.
Oh, I binge watch like constantly. Oh my God. I'm watching this show right now. What's it called? I don't even know what it's called, but it's about this 60-year-old Italian rich woman. It's Italian with subtitles. And she is having this wild sexual affair with this 30-year-old really hot guy. And the funny thing is he used to be on Grey's Anatomy. And so he's an American guy, but he's Italian and he speaks fluent Italian.
Oh,
so that was part of his character on Grey's Anatomy. And he was like, turned out to be bipolar. But anyway, this character in this series is way more interesting. So he's a con man. And he's basically, you know, what 30-year-old guy wants to be with this 60-year-old woman? And they're having these sex scenes, and I'm just going, oh, come on. You know, she's like postmenopausal. You know, there's no way they're having sex this many times, because I'm sorry, but the skin is not what it used to be when you get to be 60 years old. As much as you want to have sex 3 times in a week, it's not going to happen. Sorry. Anyway, that's kind of ruining, you know, but they leave all that out, and it's just, she is so in love with him and they're having this hot affair. So it's been pretty good. And then let me get this phone. Okay. Anyway, so that's pretty good. I'm watching that. I watched the Menendez Brothers.
Okay.
Netflix dramatization. That was really hard to watch.
Yeah.
Super hard. I do not like hearing about rape by your dad.
No, but
I watched it. But I'm putting off the documentary, but they might get released. So
yes, I saw that.
That's interesting. So what else have I watched? I'm constantly binging something, and I watch it till it's gone, you know, and then I'm like, where's more? Oh, you know what I really like? This Is It. Is that what's the one with Kristen Bell and the rabbi? That's really good, too. I watch all kinds of stuff.
How about last time you checked a review on Goodreads or Amazon? Do you check the reviews?
Oh, yeah, I always check the reviews.
I love that you're honest. So many authors tell me they don't, and I know they do.
Well, that's because they don't have the stomach for it. It's hard because there are people who are, you know, and you're like, is that somebody posing as somebody else? Because you can tell sometimes when it's somebody that you've written about that doesn't like your book, and you know, that happens. And sometimes it's just some idiot, you know, who's just a troll, and you kind of, you just have to, you know, after 15 books, you know, you kind of get used to, you just have to have a thick skin. And I try to focus on the nice ones.
How about What book are you currently reading right now?
Well, I just got in the mail yesterday. I don't remember the title of it, but it is the book that The Lincoln Lawyer Season 3 is based on.
Okay.
Michael Connelly. Guilty, as I can't remember the name of it. Gods of Guilt, I think it's called. Sorry, I started it, but I just got it and I'm going to read it because I need some help. You know, I read a lot of Michael Connelly to learn how to write, you know, crime fiction. And so now that I'm writing a series, it's kind of hard to know how much background do you put in about the characters and about the previous book with the murders that provides context for what's going on in the next book, but you can't put too much because you're not supposed to do that. So it's really tricky. So that, you know, do you just jump in with a bunch of scenes where nobody knows anything about anybody and then you tell them later, or do you weave just a little bit? So I got to read the book to just see. And I want to adapt my books to TV, and I have an agent who's encouraging me to do that. So, you know, I've got a lot of things going on, and we're about to do a performance with our band in a couple weeks. And my partner was nagging me last night. Why are you going to work on the Facebook page? Where's the logo? And I'm like, whoa, I'm busy. I got a contract to read. I got the podcast and I got the book and I'm doing the editing. And
Where are you performing out in Cali?
Just so you know, we don't call it Cali here.
Oh, it's so sorry.
California. we are playing at a brewery and it's open mic and we're going to be the featured band. We're a trio. I play the keyboards and I sing. My partner is the main singer and he plays guitar. And then we also have a bass player. And we've been playing together for years. My partner and the bass player have been playing together for 20 years. And we're opening. It's at Aztec Brewery. I'm sure everyone that you know in New York will fly out for this because we're playing for about half an hour. And then later in the night, we're going to play another, 15, 20 minutes. So, but this is our first time playing out as this group. We've been practicing for a couple of years. I was not comfortable going back out into bars, crowded bars with COVID and everything. So they were ready to go and were waiting on me. And so they were frustrated that I wasn't, but I'm ready to go now.
Ready to rock and roll. How about?
And we're called In the Lounge. So we're not actually rock and roll. We are leaning into being in the lounge. So we play jazzy, bluesy, really kind of cool stuff with, solos back and forth. And so we do some duets and
That's exciting.
It's very exciting. And the music is going to be good. And I've learned, I'm a classically trained pianist. I took lessons for 7 years when I was seven, and I didn't start practicing until I was done with lessons. But I mean, this is a whole different kind of music. This is, we do all different kinds of music, but it's, lots of improvisation and solos and it's, blues scales and it's fun.
Any famous, band or something you want to play with? Is there one person you want to play with, jam out with?
I would be too intimidated.
Of course.
I'm not that good. I mean, I'm still learning. I have huge stage fright. So, I had to learn how to be a speaker. My God, talk about feeling vulnerable. And if your voice cracks, oh my God, it'll be horrible.
All right, last two. I usually ask this to all the athletes that come on my show. But maybe you have something cool. Coolest piece of memorabilia that you own. Do you own anything cool?
I don't really collect things.
Okay.
That you would be interested in. I used to have a collection of miniatures. I've got a collection of little perfume bottles. I've got, lots of pretty colored glass and stuff. But I don't know that you would really care about that. Probably women not. Like it. I post pictures of it and people go, oh, that's so beautiful.
And last one, we'll stick with the true crime genre. Favorite true crime documentary or book, not one of your own?
I don't really have one. That's a really hard question. Um, I like the ones about the con men. You know, there was one that I watched. There was one that's kind of stuck in my mind a little bit. Well, you remember those two guys who were in prison and they got the woman to help them who was in the office and she gave them a file or something and then they all left and then she ended
in
up...
In Dannemora?
Probably.
Yes. They did a Showtime thing on it also, right?
Yeah, that was pretty good. I did not really like the Menendez one. I guess it was important for them to talk about all that molestation in such detail, but it was so hard.
No, that was difficult. That was difficult.
It was very difficult. You know, I watch a lot of them, so it's kind of, I don't really have a favorite and they kind of all blend together and I don't really remember. I thinking about the one that these guys, they take advantage of women and they, like the guy who was on Twitter. Oh, and there was another one who was like having sex and donating sperm all over Europe. You know?
Oh, yeah. I just watched that one. Yes.
Had, like thousands of children. I'm like, what's wrong with you?
I know. I actually just watched that one on a flight. I just saw that.
A true crime.
Yeah. So it was hell yeah. It was crime. Listen, this has been a blast. Please, not that you need it, but please plug the site, the Twitter, everything else you do. The book's coming out. The new novel, plug everything because you got a lot of stuff going on because it was perfectly coordinated.
Oh, yes. I look like a genius. I said to myself, I'm either going to look like a vain idiot or I'm going to look like a genius, like I planned all this. CaitlinRother.com is my website. The new band is called In the Lounge, and we are hoping to also do some recording and then put that online. So even if you don't live in town, you could still hopefully watch us play. The new books, Body Parts, Down to the Bone is the McStay Family Murder. I don't know if they're going to end up changing the titles to my novels, but the first one is called Dopamine Fix. Okay. So these titles are a series of titles, and so they have to kind of go with a theme, and I hope they don't mess with it, but publishers sometimes want to change your title because they don't get it, and they have to think that their marketing team's better than you. So the first one, the prequel, is Naked Addiction. The second one is Dopamine Fix. Then comes Corruption Cocktail, and then Cabernet Con, and then I don't have a title for the fourth one yet because I haven't started writing it, but it's basically... you know, part of the story is I've invented a sex drug, and it's different from Viagra because Viagra only works with the physical aspect of your body and, you know, makes you know what it does, but it doesn't have any psychological aspect and it's not for women. It's only for men. I mean, it's men take it. I know it is also for women, but. You know what drives me crazy? Do you see those commercials at night for Blue Chews?
Yes.
Watching these shows, I'm like, what the hell is this? And my partner's like, oh, well, that's like a Viagra thing. I'm like, really? Yes. Like, oh, I know. And women like, the most ridiculous commercials. And they're all on Lawrence O'Donnell during MSNBC during that hour. And I'm like, is this for the men or for the women? And my partner said, oh, it's for the men. I'm like, really? Okay. It's like all those ads are for sex drugs.
So
I have made up a sex drug, and there is a version for men, and a version for women, and it basically works with your dopamine receptors, and it keeps you having that new feeling.
Oh wow!
That infatuation that makes you like totally lust after
lust, but yes.
And you are so excited to see them, and you're infatuated. It makes you have that feeling all the time, and. So it's going to supposedly keep relationships together longer. But of course, you know, people think that more is better because that's what people do. And then they start abusing it. And then all kinds of crazy things start happening.
I hope that your book tour takes you to New York City so we can rock and roll, have some drinks. Because I have a bar here that gives me a private floor. And my next five guests, authors, I will tell them that I'm telling you, I'm going to send you the clip of every author I have on.
You know, if you're right, that would make me so happy.
And I won't lie, it's four of them are New York Times bestselling authors and one Pulitzer Prize winner. So I'm going to send them out. Like, do you know who she is? And once they say yes, I'm going to send it over to you, regardless if they say yes
awesome.
Or no.
Okay.
This was such a blast. Thank you so much for doing this. And good luck on your books. Not that you need it. And we will stay in touch.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Chat soon.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
When it's PCS time, you know the drill. Pack, research the new base, get the kids in school, because family supports family. At American Public University, we support military families with flexible, affordable online education that moves with you. As a military spouse, your tuition rate is the same as your partner's, just $250 per credit hour. American Public University, education that moves with you. Learn more at apu.apus.edu/military.